Happy New Year, everyone. And I hope everyone is doing well and ready to kick off another year of this, hopefully better. So it's a pleasure today to introduce Dominic Els. Dominic is currently a Moore postdoc fellow at MIT. And before that, he got his PhD from UC Santa Barbara. So Dominic is perhaps most well known for his work on time crystals, but he has many other very influential works, including classification of symmetry protected topological phases in the presence of crystal symmetries, for example. And recently he's been branching out into making very interesting universal statements about metals. So that's what we'll most likely hear about today. And Dominic, you can go ahead.
All right. Yeah, thanks. It's great to be here, to the extent that I'm here. So I'm going to tell you about metals. But before I get to metals, let me just zoom out a little bit, give you some broader context. Yes. So the subject of my talk today, and also of most of my research, is quantum many-body physics. So I'm a kinetic matter theorist, and kinetic matter systems, normally we would have some quantum degrees of freedom. And for this talk, it'll just think about these dots as atoms, and then you have electrons that can hop between atoms. So that's a model of many solid materials. And then it's a quantum system, so it's described by some Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian we're going to assume is local. So it's a sum of terms, each one of which couples some small number of local degrees of freedom. But then we consider the system in the thermodynamic limit. So this lattice will go infinitely in all directions. So we have a lattice of infinitely many quantum degrees of freedom, but with some locality structure. And then we can ask, so we have such a Hamiltonian, and then we can ask, what is the nature of a physics as the temperature approaches zero? So that means we're probing, for example, the ground state or maybe the low-lying excited states, and we would like to know what is going on in terms of this quantum many-body system at low temperatures. So right away, there's an important dichotomy that we can make between different behaviors that you could have at low temperatures. Assuming that we're talking about electrons that hop between atoms, you can ask, can these electrons conduct electricity or not if you apply an electric field? And you can talk about the conductivity of this material. So if we say the system is an insulator, if the conductivity goes to zero exponentially as the temperature goes to zero, whereas we will say it's a metal if the conductivity scales like some power law of temperature. And so one point to make is that sometimes people will distinguish between metals and semi-metals, and they would be distinguished by the sign of this exponent alpha. Whether or not the conductivity increases or decreases of temperature that would determine if it's a metal or a semi-metal. Okay, but in this talk, I will not make such a distinction. I'll just call everything a metal if it has a power law of conductivity scaling. So how do we understand these different scalings? It's related to the many-body energy spectrum of a system. So an insulator, what happens is that, so here's the ground state. Here I'm plotting all the energy eigenstates of the system. So here's the ground state. And then if we say the system is gapped, if there's a non-zero gap from the ground state to the excited states, and assuming that that gap remains non-zero in the thermodynamic limit, we say the system is gapped. And we say the system is gapless if in the thermodynamic limit, there's no gap between the ground state and the excited states. And so the reason why a gap system would be an insulator is because if you're at low temperatures, temperatures much less, smaller than the gap, then the thermal excitation of these excited states is suppressed by the Boltzmann weight, like e to the minus t over delta. And so you essentially just have the ground state, and then so you don't have excitations that could carry an electrical current. So that's why a system is insulating, whereas in a gapless system, you can have, at any non-zero temperature, you have some thermal excitation and excitations, and they can carry electrical current. So that's why you have a metallic behavior. And so we can ask, if a fundamental level, everything is just electrons hopping between atoms, very similar looking Hamiltonian. So the question is, what determines whether a given material is going to be a metal or an insulator. So at the most fundamental level, it comes from chemistry. So here's a periodic table. And then, as you probably know, the elements on the right-hand side of a periodic table tend to be metallic. Sorry, the elements on the right-hand side tend to be insulating. The elements on the left-hand side tend to be metallic. And so, for example, let's look at helium, which is here on the very rightmost column of the periodic table. Helium, the helium atoms have an outer electron shell that can hold two electrons. And in fact, each atom contributes two electrons. So these outer shell can hold two electrons, and those two electrons are present. So this shell is fully filled. So if you wanted to have an electron hop into another atom, you can't really do so because this shell is already filled and you have the Pauli exclusion principle. You could go to some higher energy state, but then you know, at low temperatures, you don't have that energy available to you. So that's why this material would be insulating. And then, okay, that's for the rightmost column of a periodic table. You can ask about something like fluorine, which has an outer shell that's not fully filled. But then fluorine atoms don't exist alone in nature. They form molecules like F2. So the molecule now you can think of as having a filled outer shell. And then it's the same basic physics as here, but you replace the atoms of molecules. So it's still insulating. And also, on the other hand, if you look at something like lithium on the other side of a periodic table, the outer shell can hold two electrons, but actually there's only one electron in the system per atom. So there's vacancies now in these outer shells, and that makes it easy for an electron to hop from one atom to another atom without paying an energy penalty. And that's how electrical conduction happens, because electrons hop and carry electrical current. So this system, so that's why this system would be a metal. So, you know, as suggested by the title of my talk, my talk is mainly going to be about metals, but I will say something about insulators, both because they are very interesting and because they will actually come up in an unexpected way later when we think about metals. So I'll get to that. So I'm going to talk about insulators. And so this picture I gave you of an insulator is what we would call, quote unquote, a trivial insulator. You know, this picture where the electrons are tightly bound to atoms and they can't hop to another atom because there's no available states to hop to. So this picture of electrons tightly bound to atoms is certainly valid in the limit where the atoms are infinitely far apart, because then there's no amplitude for the electrons to hop between atoms. But in reality, the atoms are not infinitely far apart. You have some amplitude for the electrons to hop from one atom to the other atom, but it can't really, an electron can't hop to another atom and stay there, because then it would have to pay the energy penalty, as I mentioned before. But you can have virtual processes where the electron hops to another atom and then comes back. So what is the effect of these virtual processes? Or you can think of them as some kind of quantum fluctuations. It's nice to think of it in terms of entanglement. So if you think of these atoms as being quantum degrees of freedom, you can think of the ground state of your system where the electrons are tightly bound as being a product state between these quantum degrees of freedom. So there's no entanglement in this state. But now if we switch on these quantum fluctuations, what happens? Well, it's going to introduce some entanglement into the ground state now. So the ground state is no longer a product state, it's an entangled state. But it's still continuously deformable into a product state. You can, you know, just switch off the tunneling amplitudes and it'll go, the ground state would go back to a product state. But then there are different kind of insulator called a topological insulator. And this topological insulator of a ground state has many body entanglement, and it's a much more non-trivial kind of many body entanglement, because there's no way to continuously connect this ground state back to a product state. So in fact, these topological insulators, which have this non-trivial many body entanglement, they are a distinct phase of matter compared with a trivial insulator, because there's no way to continuously deform the ground state of the topological insulator into a ground state of trivial insulator without crossing through a phase transition. So these are distinct phases of matter. And then there's one other interesting property of topological insulators. Here I will focus on, there's different kinds of topological insulators. I will focus on the so-called integer type topological insulator. There are some other kinds that I won't talk about here. But anyway, these integer type topological insulators, they have this non-trivial many-body quantum entanglement. And this has a very striking signature, which is, suppose we have a material with these atoms, but we consider a material with a boundary. So material is here in the green region, but then we have a boundary, and on the other side we have just vacuum, for example. So then we have a surface. So it turns out that the surface has to be metallic, even though the system is insulating in the bulk. It actually has to be metallic on the boundary, and its metallicity is not an accident. It's actually enforced by the fact that you're on the boundary of a non-trivial topological phase if it's non-trivial many-body quantum entanglement. So that's this topological insulator is a very rich subject. There's much theory to be done there, and it's something that I've worked on quite a bit as well. But it's not really the topic of this talk. But on the other hand, the theory of topological insulators will actually arise in an unexpected way, as we'll see later on. And so you'll see how that comes about. You can watch out for that. But for the moment, I'm going to talk about metals. So I have this picture of metals that I just gave you before, which is that, you know, you have these electron shells, but there's vacancies. So the electrons are free to move between atoms due to the vacancies. Now the electron shells always have can hold an even number of electrons because you always have this spin quantum number, which can distinguish between two states. But for pedagogical reasons, in this talk, I want to simplify my life and your lives. So I will just assume that the electrons don't have spin. When talking about non-relativistic systems here, there's no spin statistics theorem or anything like that to worry about. So we can just assume that the electrons have no spin. It's just a simplifying assumption. You can generalize it. Okay, so assume no spin, and then that means that the electron shells don't have to come in pairs anymore. You can have just an electron shell that holds just a single electron. And now if you have only one electron per atom, then the system would go back to being an insulator, because now you again have this obstruction to electrons hopping between atoms, because the shell can only hold one electron and it's already there. So if you want to get back to a metal, which is what I want to talk about, we will have to remove some electrons to get the vacancies back. So in particular, you want the average number of electrons per atom to be not an integer, to be some fractional number, because that's when you would have vacancies. And so then the electrons are free to hop again, and you would expect to get metallic behavior. So to that end, let me define this number, which is going to be a really important number throughout my talk. I call it mu, and it's called the filling. And it's the average number of electrons per translation unit cell. So in this simple picture, it's just the average number of electrons per atom. Because in general, we want to account for situations where, for example, the atoms form molecules. So a translation unit cell could contain more than one atom. So in general, we should define the filling to be the number of electrons per translation unit cell. And so because of the reasons I just gave you to get a metallic state, you want the mu not to be an integer. Okay, so that's all very good. We have some system with electrons hopping between atoms, and we ensure that the number of electrons per atom is not an integer. We should get a metallic state, but what is the nature of the ground state of that metallic system? That's a question you can ask. So we can start by making a very drastic approximation, which is that we ignore the Coulomb repulsion between electrons. So then the electrons talk to each other only through fermionic statistics and through the Pauli exclusion principle, but there's no direct energetic interaction between the electrons. Apart from the statistics, they kind of just move independently. So now this is a free electron problem, or it's a non-interacting electron problem, which means that the Hamiltonian is just a quadratic in the fermion operators. So this is a non-interacting problem. And as you may know, in this case, this Hamiltonian is exactly solvable, because all we need to do is diagonalize the hopping matrix. So here the I and J are just the labels for which atom you're on. So we can solve this Hamiltonian exactly. You just need to find the single particle states of this Hamiltonian. And if you have translational symmetry, then momentum is a good quantum number, so you can label single particle states by their momentum. We have a dispersion relation, the energy of the single particle states versus momentum. And then what is the ground state of the system? You just fill up the lowest single particle states until you've accommodated all of the electrons that are in the system. And here again, we can see why we wanted for this fill in U not to be an integer. Because if a fill in U was an integer, then this band would be fully filled. And fully filled bands don't conduct electricity, they're insulating. To get a metallic state, you want a partially filled band. So that's why we want U not to be an integer. Okay. So that was the one-dimensional picture. Of course, in higher dimensions, the story is similar. We can talk about single particle states labeled by the X and Y components of momentum, and then you have the occupied single particle states, the unoccupied single particle states. And then there's this surface, the Fermi surface, which is the boundary in momentum space between the occupied states and the unoccupied states. And if you think about the low energy excitations of a system, so this is the ground state, if you think about low energy excitations of a system, it would be like you add an electron near the Fermi surface, or you remove electron near the Fermi surface. So low energy excitations of a system live near the Fermi surface. Okay, so this is all well and good, but this is all based on the assumption that you have this no interaction. So you've assumed absence of this Coulomb repulsion, but that's not a realistic assumption for the materials we want to describe. So you have to put back the Coulomb repulsion term, but the problem is that then the Hamiltonian is not solvable anymore because this term will be quadratic in the this term will be quartic in the fermion operators. So this isn't, if you add the Coulomb repulsion term, this Hamiltonian is not solvable anymore. It's some strongly interacting Hamiltonian. Okay, what do we do now? So it's too much to ask. Yeah, so we need to go beyond this non-interacting approximation. And it's too much to ask to be able to solve this Hamiltonian exactly now. I mean, solving quantum many-body Hamiltonians is not a tractable problem. But we can do something a little bit less, which is still very useful, which you can think about effective field theories. So you think about at the microscopic scale, you have the detailed microscopic physics of a system. You have electrons hopping between atoms with a Coulomb repulsion or whatever terms you want to add in the Hamiltonian. But then suppose we're only interested in the physics at low energy, long wavelengths, low temperature, et cetera. Then this physics can be described, we expect that it can be described by an effective field theory. So there's some field theoretic description of a system that applies only at these low energy, long wavelength scales. And if you'd like, you can think of the relationship between the microscopic scale and the this effective field theory as being the result of a renormalization group flow. So like you're coarse graining the system, you're forgetting about the microscopic details and you're keeping only the long wavelength information. Okay, so even if we can't solve a Hamiltonian, we can at least hope to find what the correct effective field theory to describe the low energy physics is. So what would it be? So if you have a trivial insulator, the effective field theory would literally just be the null field theory, by which I mean the field theory that doesn't contain any fields. And that's because at low temperatures or low energies, you're below this gap. And so you literally just have a ground state and there's no non-trivial dynamics going on in this system at all. So that's why it would be the null field theory. Topological insulators, you still have a gap, but there's still some kind of global topological information associated with this ground state. And this is captured by a so-called topological quantum field theory. This talk is mainly about metals. And so we can ask, what is the effective field theory to describe to metals? And one effective field theory, which was proposed a long time ago by Landau and has been proved extremely successful is Fermi liquid theory. So how does Fermi liquid theory work? Well, you'll notice that this 1957 was maybe before the concept of effective field theory even had been proposed, but in some sense, Landau was describing an effective field theory, and certainly that's how we understand it today. So what is the nature of this effective field theory? So remember I told you that for a non-interacting electron system, you have this Fermi surface, and with low energy excitations live near the Fermi surface. It turns out in Fermi liquid theory, it's kind of the same thing, but you still have a Fermi surface and the low energy excitations still live near the Fermi surface. And because it's an effective field theory, it only describes the low energy excitations. So it really only describes the physics in some thin shell around the Fermi surface. And then this effective field theory actually has a Hamiltonian, which you can write down explicitly. And the Hamiltonian has this form. NK is basically the occupation number of some fermionic mode at momentum K. So I've had only this first term. This will just be a non-interacting Hamiltonian, similar to what I was just discussing before for the non-interacting case. But then we do have this extra term, which is an interaction term that couples electrons. It's quadratic in the occupation number, so quartic in the electron operators. So we do have interactions, but on the other hand, this actually Hamiltonian is actually solvable still because it's diagonal in the basis of the occupation numbers of these fermionic modes. So this is nice that we have this effective field theory described by a solvable Hamiltonian still. And if you think about how these fermionic modes are related to the microscopic electrons, they're kind of dressed versions of the microscopic electrons. So we call these quasi-particles on the Fermi surface. So this effective field theory seems to be the correct effective field theory for many metallic materials. I mean, there's brilliant agreement with experiment in many materials, but not all materials. There are some materials which are clearly not described by Fermi liquid theory. Okay, so it means that us condensed matter theorists are not yet out of a job, because it means we still need to explain what is the correct effective field theory for these non-Fermi liquid metals that are not described by Fermi liquid theory. So there's a lot of experimental materials that we could discuss in this context. Let me just mention one class of materials, which is actually a very famous class, is of doped cuprates. For example, a paradigmic example is YBCO, yttrium barium copper oxide. The biggest reason why these materials are very famous is because they exhibit high temperature superconductivity. For example, YBCO has a critical temperature for superconductivity of 93 Kelvin, which is much larger than any material that had been known before YBCO was discovered. And it's also too large to be explained by conventional theories of superconductivity. So of course, high temperature superconductivity is great practical interest, but these materials from a theoretical point of view are very interesting, not just for superconductivity, but for many other reasons. So here's a phase diagram, a schematic phase diagram of a typical doped cuprate material. So here I've plotted temperature and the doping strength, because you dope in with some impurities, and so you can control the doping strength. And so here, this region, red region, which I labeled SC, it stands for superconductor. This is the superconducting region. And here is the critical temperature, which is very high, as I said. But above the superconducting dome, there's also interesting things happening. And there's this metallic regime, which people have called the strange metal. So if you suppress the superconductivity, which you can actually do by applying a magnetic field, for example, the strange metal seems to go all the way down to zero temperature. So it's an example of one of these zero temperature ground states of a quantum many body system that I set up for you at the beginning of this talk. So we want to understand that state and in particular understand the effective field theory that describes the low energy physics of this state. And the answer is not really known, and it's not for lack of trying. There's been intense theoretical interest in this strange metal for a long time, but it's evaded satisfactory theoretical description for the moment. It seems to be a very hard problem. And I think many people would consider this one of the major unsolved problems in condensed matter physics. So strange metal is a very intrinsically interesting state, and then it might also be interested into, from point of view, understanding the superconductivity, because the strange metal may be perhaps the parent state of a superconductor. So like you think of a superconductor as coming from some instability of a strange metal. So if you understand the strange metal, it might also help you understand the high temperature superconductivity. Okay, so as I said, it's not knowing what the effective theory of a strange metal is, but it's certainly not Fermi liquid theory. There are many experimental signatures you can look at to prove that it's not Fermi liquid theory, but I'll just mention one, which is that the Fermi liquid theory has a resistivity that scales with temperature at low temperatures, like at temperature squared. A strange metal resistivity goes like proportional to temperature. That's what experimentally they observe. So we need to come up with an effective theory of a strange metal. It's probably, whatever it turns out to be, it'll be something very interesting. Probably it's some strongly coupled quantum field theory. This Fermi liquid theory was this solvable theory, but a strange metal probably will be some strongly coupled quantum field theory. And as we know, it's very hard to understand strongly coupled field theories in general, let alone to find out which one is the correct one for describing strange metal. So that's maybe why it's been difficult to make progress. So full disclosure, I'm not going to solve this problem in this talk. I'm not going to tell you what the effective field theory of a strange metal is, but I will say something else, which is that even without knowing what the effective field theory of a strange metal is, we can still learn something about what properties an effective field theory of a strange metal would have to have based on very general arguments. And I think that in itself represents a lot of progress, and maybe it will also stimulate progress further later on. So how are we going to do this? We're going to do this by revisiting very closely this idea of the filling, which I introduced previously, and then what does it imply about the effective field theory. So the idea is we have these macroscopic degrees of freedom, electrons hopping between atoms, et cetera, and then we expect in some coarse-grained sense it's described by an effective field theory. But we don't really know how to predict what the effective field theory is, even if we knew what the macroscopic Hamiltonian is. It's just not a tractable problem to do that. But what we can hope to do is to constrain, given microscopic properties of the system, at least derive some constraints that the effective field theory would have to satisfy. And so that's what I'm going to do for you. And so what are ways that one could do that? Well, first of all, we can talk about symmetry, because whatever the symmetry is of a microscopic Hamiltonian, you know, the effective theory has to represent that symmetry in some way. I mean, that's just a fundamental statement. Well, you could ask about spontaneous symmetry breaking. In some sense, even if the symmetry is spontaneously broken, it's still present in the effective field theory. It's just if the ground state breaks the symmetry. But in any case, certainly if you don't have spontaneous symmetry breaking, the effective field theory has to represent whatever the microscopic symmetry is. So in this talk, I will assume a particular microscopic symmetry of this form. So Z to the D means lattice translation symmetry. So you have some lattice system and you can translate by one lattice constant. That's the symmetry. So by assuming this, it means that we're assuming clean system without impurities, because if you had random impurities, they would break this translation symmetry. So we're considering clean systems. And then I also assume charge conservation symmetry, that's just conservation of number of electrons, basically. And so these are the ingredients you need to define the filling, which, as I mentioned before, it's the average charge of a system per unit cell, or average number of electrons per unit cell. And so this is the question, what does these properties of a microscopic level, what does that imply about the effective field theory of a system? So let me give you some prior results that are kind of special cases of what we eventually will show. So one of them is this so-called LSM-OH theorem. So the theorem says that if you have this symmetry group, as I defined it, let's assume it's not spontaneously broken, and we can define the filling, which is the average number of electrons per unit cell. The theorem says that if nu is not an integer, then the ground state must be a metallic state. So this is consistent with the intuition I gave you before about if you have vacancies, which is what happens when a nu is not an integer, then you can have some quantum fluctuation of these vacancies and the electrons can hop between atoms and you expect metallic behavior. And so this theorem is basically just formalizing that into a theorem. Well, there are actually some loopholes to this theorem, but I don't want to go into that today. So another result along these lines is the so-called Luffinger's theorem. So this is a statement about Fermi-Liquid theory. So remember, Fermi-Liquid theory is this very successful effective theory that describes many materials, though not all. So it has, it's particular of its effective field theory has this Fermi surface. And Luffinger's theorem says that this microscopic filling is related to the volume enclosed in momentum space by the Fermi surface. And it's mod one, because if the nu was an integer, then the system could be an insulator, in which case it has no Fermi surface. So it's clear that this equation has to hold mod one. So this again is a connection between the low energy effective field theory, which is Fermi surface is a property of a low energy effective field theory, and a microscopic property of a microscopic filling.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yes.
Sorry, it's Pedro here. I'm not from Condensed Matter, so a very naive question. So in the previous slide, when you say this theorem that you mentioned there, so being metallic, is it equivalent to being gapless?
That's a good point. I mean, it's not completely equivalent to being gapless in the sense that you could have gapless excitations which are uncharged and then they don't conduct electricity. So then the system would at least be an electrical insulator, but maybe it will be a thermal conductor, it can conduct heat. But I think the theorem, well, depending on how you formulate it, but I think it is true that the ground state must be a metallic and not just gapless.
I see. So it's gapless and the excitations are charged under this U1.
Yes, correct. Yes.
I see. Okay. Thank you. And what is the basic idea of the proof? It just looks quite cute.
There's some nice argument that you thread flux, and if the system you put the system on a circle or on a torus and you thread flux adiabatically, and then that leads to a change in momentum. So then if the system was gapped, then it wouldn't be able to accommodate this change of momentum, where if it's gapless, it can accommodate the change of momentum.
Okay. Okay, I'll ask you later. Okay, it sounds very cute. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, so this might be a good point for questions, since I kind of set up the problem that I'm going to solve, and then the rest of the talk will be telling you the answer. So if there are any more questions on what I'm trying to do, that would be a good time.
Okay, maybe I could also ask another naive question. In the previous slide, you also have a very, it looks like a very fundamental result in the previous slide about the volume of the Fermi surface and the microscopic filling. Can you also give some intuition again for the non-experts? What's the basic intuition behind this result? The basic idea of the derivation of these results?
What I think I maybe forgot to mention is that if you had a non-interacting system, then it just literally just follows by state counting, because you have to fill up some number of states in momentum space, which is how many electrons you have, and then it will just follow from state counting.
Okay.
But that's kind of a trivial result. The more non-trivial result is for an interacting system where you have an effective field theory. And the argument actually itself, I mean, there are different arguments one can make. And then all these results will be special cases of the approach I will tell you later on. But the argument is also actually, it's kind of in some sense the same argument as the previous one. You do this adiabatically freed electric flux, and then you have to be able to accommodate a certain amount of momentum. The amount of momentum that the system accommodates is precisely proportional to the volume of the Fermi surface. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so maybe I will move on. So I need to answer in general, what are the properties of effective field theory that are related to these microscopic properties, like the filling? And the answer will turn out to be, So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these, these special cases which I mentioned in the previous slides, and generalize them to a very high degree. And the answer turns out to be that the properties of effective field theory that are related to this microscopic filling is two things. First of all, the emergent symmetry, and secondly, the anomaly of that emergent symmetry. So emergent symmetry, what does that mean? It's just saying that so microscopically you have some symmetry, but the emergent symmetry can be, the effective field theory can be much larger than the microscopic symmetry. So if effective field theory has some symmetry, but it's not a symmetry that exists microscopically, we call that an emergent symmetry. And secondly, there's this concept of an anomaly, which is a field theory concept that ends up being very important. So let me talk about now what I mean by an anomaly. So I'm going to give an example, first of all, that might be most familiar to particle physicists. For people who are not particle physicists or not familiar with this example, you can hand in there, because I'm going to talk about some other examples later. Here's an example for particle physicists. It's the massless Dirac fermion, and let's say it's in 3 plus 1D, for example, four space-time dimensions. It has a Lagrangian with Dirac spinners and Kammer matrices, et cetera. And it has two conserved currents. It has the regular conserved current, and it has the axial current. So the axial current would be broken if you had a mass term, but in a massless Dirac fermion, this axial current is preserved. This axial current is conserved. So it means you have a U1 times U1 symmetry of this problem. But now the thing is that if you couple to a background electromagnetic field, then the axial current is no longer conserved. You have a continuity equation for this axial current, which is violated by a non-trivial right-hand side, which is proportional to the background field. So E and B have the background electric magnetic fields. And so this is a quantum effect. I mean, you don't really see it at the classical Lagrangian level, but if you quantize the theory properly, you'll see this violation of continuity equation. So that's an example of the anomalies that I'm going to talk about. So let me also say something more concrete. I'm just considering a one-dimensional Fermi gas. So Fermi gas has just been this non-interacting electron system that I introduced previously. So you have this dispersion relation. You fill up the low-energy single particle states up to some, up to the chemical potential. And then you have the Fermi surface here is literally just two points for KL and KR. If you think about the effective theory that describes the low energy physics system, it's actually equivalent to a Dirac fermion in 1 plus 1D. And the way to see that is you linearize this dispersion regression about for these points, because that's where the KO and KR are the points where the low energy excitations are. So you can just linearize the dispersion regression. So then you get something like this. And then if you bring these modes together, you get a Dirac fermion. And this is a 1 plus 1D Dirac fermion. So if you don't know about Dirac fermions, you don't need to worry about that. I mean, you can just think of it from this point of view, it's a non-interacting Fermi gas. But anyway, the point is that you have this system has an emergent U1 times U1 symmetry. And the reason from this point of view is you can think of it in terms of the left moving and right moving charges. So if you think about particles over here near KL, they have a group velocity, DEDK, which is going to the left. And if you think about particles over here, they have a group velocity that's going to the right. So we call them left movers and right movers. And you can talk about the total charge of left movers and the total charge of right movers. And these are numbers that are separately conserved. So that's why you have a U1 times U1 symmetry. It's for left moving and right moving charges. But the system actually has an anomaly in a similar way to the 3 plus 1D Dirac fermion that I talked about before. The Dirac fermion in general have anomalies for any even space-time dimensions. So in particular, here we're talking about 1 plus 1 space-time dimensions. But anyway, you can see these left and right moving currents have a non-trivial continuity equation, and the continuity equation is violated by a right-hand side proportional to the electric field. So it's very easy to see why that happens in the point of view of this non-interacting Fermi, non-interacting electron system. We have some electrons that are occupying the single particle states. And now what happens when you apply an electric field? The electrons feel a force. So the momentum has a non-trivial time derivative. So it means that in momentum space, if the electrons move, so I have an animation here. I don't know how well you can see it, but the electrons move in momentum space in the direction of the electric field. So that means you have a charge accumulating on the right moving point and charge deficit of the left moving point. So that's why the left moving and right moving charges are no longer separately conserved in the presence of this electric field. So that's the explanation for this anomaly. So this anomaly and also the one for the Dirac fermion that I talked about in the previous slide are both examples of what I call a Tu-Hooft anomaly. So in general, what I mean by Tu-Hooft anomaly is that so a Tu-Hooft anomaly is a non-conservation of charge in the presence of a background gauge field. So for example, in the previous slide, I applied an electric field, which is a gauge field for the U1 symmetry. And then you saw that the left and right moving charges are no longer conserved. So that's the general definition of a Tu-Hooft anomaly. But there's an interesting thing about Tu-Hooft anomalies, which is they're closely connected to these topological insulators that I introduced before. So this is where I promised you the topological insulators were going to come back. So now is when they're coming back. So topological insulator, I told you, it's this state which has a non-trivial many-body quantum entanglement, as a consequence of which the system is insulating the bulk but metallic on the boundary. But it's actually not just that the system is metallic on the boundary, it actually also has this Tu-Hooft anomaly. And that's almost the defining feature of this topological insulator, is that they have these Tu-Hooft anomalies on the boundary. And then you remember the Tu-Hooft anomaly is this non-conservation of charge in response to a background gauge field. You can sort of think of that charge as coming from the bulk. So if you consider the bulk plus boundary theory, the charge would be conserved. But if you consider the boundary theory on its own, there's charge inflow from the bulk, which is why charge is not conserved on the boundary. And so because of this connection, there's actually a one-to-one correspondence between Tu-Hooft anomalies in d-spatial dimensions and topological insulators in one more dimension. So that's an interesting fact about Tu-Hooft anomaly. So it's tying back to this theory of topological insulators. But the reason I bring up these Tu-Hooft anomalies is, as I said, it's going to be very closely connected to the filling, and it's going to let you understand these constraints between the microscopic physics and the effective field theory. And in particular, in order to illustrate that, I'm going to rederive Luttinger's theorem. So remember, Luttinger's theorem was this statement about the relationship between the microscopic microscopic filling and the volume enclosed by the Fermi surface. So between a microscopic property and a property of the low energy effective theory. So that's the 2D version, but to make things simple, I will focus just on 1D, one spatial dimension. So 1 plus 1, 2 space-time dimensions. So here the Fermi surface is literally just 2 points, KL and KR. You saw that previously. And so the statement will be that the volume enclosed by the Fermi surface, which is just KL minus KR, is proportional to the microscopic ceiling. And so how do I prove that? I'm going to say that it's the consequence of this Tu-Hooft anomaly. So here is the Fermi surface, KL and KR, and it has this U1 times U1 symmetry, emergent symmetry. I apply it after a field to get a non-conservation of charge. And I want to say that that actually implies Schlesinger's theorem. So let's see how that works. And this is going to be the most technical slide of my talk, I guess. But I think it's good to illustrate the methods that we use, and then we'll get back to more general statements. For simplicity, I'm going to assume a microscopic continuous translation symmetry. Before, I was assuming microscopic lattice translation symmetries, discrete translation symmetry. So I'm assuming microscopic continuous translation symmetry only to make things simpler. We can do this argument in more generally as well. But anyway, if you have microscopic continuous translation symmetry, then you know it's generated by a momentum operator. And then we have to say, how does that momentum operator act in the low energy theory? And it acts basically in this way. So here we have, remember, we have this left moving and right moving charges, which are the generators of a U1 times U1 symmetry. And then we have a KL and KR, which are just for the locations in momentum space of the Fermi surface. And so the momentum will just be have this form, because if you have a certain amount of left moving charge at KL and a certain amount of right moving charge at KR, and obviously this is how much momentum in total you have. So that's how momentum acts in the low energy theory. And then remember that these left moving and right moving charges are non-conserved if I apply an electric field. So if I think about the densities of left and right moving charges, which are what I show here, they have a non-zero time derivative. So NL dot is the time derivative of NL, and it's non-zero proportional to the electric field. And then so momentum is expressed in terms of these left and right moving charges from this equation. It means the momentum density has a non-zero time derivative with this equation. So that's in the effective theory, but we also know microscopically to have a change of momentum density, because this momentum is a microscopic symmetry, we can ask that question about microscopically, what is the change of rate of change of momentum density? It has to be of this form, where E is the electric field, rho is the microscopic charge density, which is the continuous translation symmetry analog of the ceiling. Because you have continuous translation symmetry, all you can say is you have some uniform charge density. That's what we call rho. And so the momentum, time derivative momentum has to be of this form. If you think about it, because E times rho is the density of force which the system experiences due to the electric field. Or more generally, you can, in a quantum level, you can derive this formula from gauge invariance. So this has to be true in an exact sense. So now all we need to do is compare these two equations. We have two different expressions for P dot, which we equate. And then we find a relation between rho for microscopic charge density and KR minus KL. So this indeed is Schlesinger's theorem. It's the relation between microscopic charge density and the volume enclosed by the Fermi surface. So here I assume continuous translation symmetry, as I said. So if it was discrete translation symmetry, the rho would become nu, the filling, and then you also get an additional mod one statement in a discrete case. But anyway, so that's Schlesinger's theorem. And as you see, it just comes from this anomaly, basically. And so you can do similar things for higher dimensional Fermi liquids. It's interesting to think about what is the emergent symmetry of a Fermi liquid in higher dimension. So here I'm focusing on the two-dimensional case, two spatial dimensions. And turns out it's this thing called the loop group, which is a kind of a fun group. It's a group of all smooth functions from the circle into U1. That's what we call the loop group. And that's the emergent symmetry of the 2D Fermi liquid. And physically, what it's saying is that every point of a Fermi surface has a separately conserved charge. Remember, in the 1D case, we had separately conserved charges in the left moving and right moving points. But here we have a whole continuous Fermi surface, and the charge at every point of a Fermi surface is separately conserved. And that's just clear from this Hamiltonian. So you have a very large emergent symmetry group here. It's actually infinite dimensional. So you have infinitely many conserved quantities. And then what we show in this paper is if you consider the Tu-Hooft anomalies of this loop group, you can indeed, in a sort of analogous way to what we did in the 1D case in the previous slides, you can indeed derive Schlesinger's theorem. So I'm not going to go into the details of that today, but anyway, we showed that you can do this. But now the point is that we don't need to confine ourselves just to Fermi liquids. I mean, what I was trying to do was to understand non-Fermi liquids, so metals which are not described by this Fermi liquid theory. But whatever the effective field theory is, it still has an emergent symmetry and it still has a Tu-Hooft anomaly. And so we can stateless a very general principle. The Tuft anomaly in emergent symmetry, because of his similar arguments to what I just said, is related to his microscopic scaling. And in fact, I don't want you to worry too much about the general details here. I just want to show you that from the properties of the effective field theory, just in basically emergent symmetry and the anomaly, we actually wrote down a general formula that just from these properties tells you what the filling is microscopically. And so here's a general formula. And again, I don't want you to worry about the details. I'm just flashing this to prove to you, if you like, that I have a general formula and what we derive this formula in the paper. So what can we do with this approach? We can, as I said, rewrite past results like Luttinger's theorem, et cetera. But I think we get a fresh modern perspective on these results, which is nice. But we can go further and derive new results. And that's the most exciting thing. And one of the results we derived is this thing called the compressibility theorem. It says that if the spatial dimension is greater than or equal to 2, and if the emergent symmetry group, which is what we call GIR, is a compact finite dimensional Lie group, then we prove from this general formula that the filling nu must be a rational number. So if you turn this around, if the filling nu is an irrational number, we conclude that the emergent symmetry group must be an infinite dimensional group. So we have infinitely many conserved quantities. Now we saw in the Fermi liquid theory that that's the case. And indeed, Fermi liquid theory can exist fine in irrational filling. So that all checks out. But it's maybe more unexpected this would be true generally. I mean, we do expect that for a metallic system that mu can be any number, it doesn't have to be rational. I mean, certainly if you think about this vague picture that I have, if you just create some vacancies and electrons are free to hop between atoms, there's no reason why the number of electrons per atom has to be any rational number. It can be any number, you can continuously tune it. So we expect therefore that every metal can exist irrational filling. And that means that we learn something very profound about metals, which is they always come with an infinite dimensional emergent symmetry group. You have this very non-trivial emergent symmetry structure, and it's just unavoidable. And I think that probably surprises people. I mean, people knew about this emergent symmetry group in the Fermi liquid case, but I think many people thought that it wouldn't be present in the non-Fermi liquids. But from this general structure, it's clear that it's inevitable. So we have learned something very profound about metals. And so that will, I expect, to influence all future studies of non-Fermi liquids, because you have to incorporate this infinite dimensional symmetry group.
So Dominic?
Yes.
Can it be finite dimensional non-compact group?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we don't have a rigorous proof that that is not possible. Seems unlikely. I mean, so there's a subtlety here, which is that the emergent symmetry group that we're discussing is the internal symmetries, not the, we don't include, for example, translation symmetry in the effective theory. The GIR is just the internal symmetries of the effective theory. I don't know of any well-defined quantum field theory that has a internal non-compact symmetry. We don't have a rigorous proof that that's not possible. I suspect it's probably not possible.
But this, the continuous momentum is one candidate, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's not if it's momentum, it's a translation symmetry. That's not an internal symmetry. So that's not what we're talking about.
It acts as an internal symmetry in the low energy theory.
Yeah, the translation acts as an internal symmetry in the low energy theory. So the question is, can you have such an internal symmetry that is non-compact? Like, for example, in the Fermi liquid case, or for example, let's take the 1 plus 1D Fermi gas. You have this U1 times U1 symmetry. So that's a compact symmetry. The translation embeds into the U1, but the full symmetry group is a compact symmetry.
But I want to understand. So you said infinite dimensional group is inevitable, but in principle, you can, if you have a finite dimensional non-compact group, then you don't need to have infinite dimensional.
In principle, yes. The question is whether that actually can happen. I don't, as I said, I can't prove, but I suspect that it cannot happen. So that's maybe an asterisk on this theorem.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe a follow-up question.
Right.
Suppose I consider 3 plus 1D QED without matter. And can I view the T duality transformation as a Z symmetry? So its action is to change the theta angle by 2 pi, or if you want, you can change by 4 pi.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I guess I would have to think about that. Yeah, sorry.
Thanks.
Okay. So now I want to tell you in the final minutes of my talk.
Sorry, can I ask a basic question?
Yes, sure.
So I'm still a bit confused by what Sung Sik was asking. So if I understand correctly, being non-compact, it could be just difference between U1 and R or something simple like that, right? But being infinite dimensional is much more, it's a much stronger statement, right? If you have an infinite dimensional symmetry group, it's really something much more.
Yeah, but we know of a system which has an infinite dimensional symmetry group, for example, this Fermi liquid, and we don't know of a system that has this non-compact finite dimensional symmetry group. So I don't know how you define non-trivial, but it's in some sense, it's easier to contemplate infinite dimensional groups like the loop group, because we already know examples of those that are actually in actual systems.
So these are infinite dimensional symmetries in how many dimensions? 2+1?
In any spatial dimension greater than one, you would have this structure, yeah.
But just to make sure, your theorem doesn't exclude the finite dimensional non-compact group, right?
It does not exclude it, no.
Okay.
It feels very pathological to have that, but I don't have a proof of why you could never have that.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure why you think it's pathological. So suppose I have emergent continuous momentum conservation. So microscopic symmetry only preserves the discrete momentum, but in the low energy theory, the continuous momentum is conserved. So that can happen, right? And that is.
Yeah, the question is whether it exists as a bare symmetry, whether it's a subgroup of a compact group. Like
that is kind of the smallest group that satisfy your theorem, right? And whether that can be enlarged to infinite dimensional group or not, maybe that's possible, but that's kind of minimal. Smallest group that satisfies your condition.
Yeah, I mean, the strict theorem, as I said, does not exclude that, but it would be surprising to me if you could have it. It seems, well, without going into details, like, for example, Tuft anomalies are very difficult to define for those groups. I suspect what that's telling you is that they're not physical, unless they're enlarged to a bigger group, but I don't know for sure.
So, I mean, if you don't have infinite dimensional emergent symmetry in the first place, then I don't know whether there is a meaning to define anomaly for that.
Well, so any group should have an anomaly.
But suppose if you don't have infinitely many conserved quantities in the first place, right? For example, you can have a pairing interaction that mix particle number at different angle. So then certainly you don't have that symmetry.
Well, you don't have it as a, I mean.
You don't have infinitely many symmetry, I guess.
Well, it depends what the ultimate state is, right? You could break the bare symmetry, but then have a new emergent symmetry. So I don't know how to predict what would happen in that case.
Sorry, I'm coming from outside the field, so this may be a stupid question, but so if it's a non-compact group, then it has no finite dimensional unitary representations. Would that lead to any problems?
Well, if it's a non-compact, a non-abelian group, maybe that's true, but it could the abelian groups have obviously one-dimensional representations, so.
Okay.
OK, Okay, let me maybe keep going because I just want some. I'm kind of building up to the climax here. So I wanted to talk about the applications to strange metals, which is I think the most exciting application of this stuff. So remember, the strange metals is this very mysterious state of matter that exists in doped cuprates, for example, and it goes down to zero temperature, and we don't really know what's going on, and we would like to know what the effective field theory of a strange metal is. So, yeah, I cannot tell you what the effective theory of a strange metal is, but I can tell you what certain properties of effective theory of a strange metal will need to have due to these general constraints. So we're going to, instead of trying to say what the effective field theory is, we're just going to make some simple assumptions about the nature of a strange metal, which actually come in large part from experiment, and see what general consequences we can learn from that, from these general arguments. So we're learning something about strange metals through very general arguments. And so the assumptions we're going to make, first of all, I'm going to assume the system is clean. So there's no impurities, because that's just saying that I was assuming translation symmetry. And then I assume the system can exist at irrational filling. So what I just told you in the previous slides is that these two assumptions apply, okay, modulo the caveats we've just been discussing, infinitely many conserved quantities. But that's not all, because okay, we make one more assumption. So this would be true also for Fermi liquids, these two assumptions. But we make one more assumption, which also comes from experiment, which is you plot conductivity as a function of frequency and as a function of temperature. And it has this scale invariant form. And the scaling function sigma is just some function of one argument, and sigma zero is a finite number. That's what the experiments are telling us. So it's maybe not so surprising that you have this scale invariant form, because at low temperatures you expect to be described your effective field to be a renormalization group fixed point. So there's some scale invariance associated with that. So then it would make sense you have this scale invariant form. But the more interesting thing is that this sigma zero is a finite number. So we can contrast that with what happens in Fermi liquid theory. In Fermi liquid theory, you plot the conductivity as a function of frequency and temperature. It actually is just proportional to a delta function and independent of temperature. So this is scale invariant. It has the same scaling form as I wrote down before, but is at omega equals zero, you see that this sigma zero is infinite, which is just representing the fact that the DC conductivity is infinite. At this point, you may object, well, isn't the conductivity of real metal finite? Well, firstly, there's impurities, which would make it finite. But secondly, even if you idealize the impurities away, there's a dangerously irrelevant terms that you can add to this Hamiltonian. I don't want to get into this point too much, because it's a bit technical. It's just trying to address this point of why is the DC conductivity not actually infinite in a real material. But in any case, if you just throw out these irrelevant terms and you just look at this Fermi liquid theory, the DC conductivity is infinite, and it's because of this delta function. So this is the contrast of strange metals. Of strange metals, it has a scaling form, but with sigma zero being finite. But then this kind of presents a conundrum, because why is the DC conductivity infinite? It comes from these conserved quantities. The fact that you have this conserved charge at each point of the Fermi surface, the current has overlap with these conserved quantities. So the current cannot relax. And that's precise. If a current can flow without relaxing, even in the absence of any external field, that's what we mean by infinite DC conductivity. But it seems like that's an inevitable consequence of the DC conductivity, of the conserved quantities. And I just told you that the strange metal must also have these conserved quantities because of general arguments. So how do we reconcile this? Without going into the details, there's one way to get rid of this delta function and make its coefficient be zero, essentially. And that's there's a certain susceptibility of it must diverge. And that's the only way to get rid of this delta function if you have these conserved quantities. So we've reached a strong conclusion about the nature of a strange metal. We've predicted that it has this divergence susceptibility just based on these extremely general arguments. And so whatever effective field theory, hopefully in the future, we will be able to come up with an effective field theory of a strange metal, but whatever it is, it will have to satisfy these constraints, infinitely many conserved quantities, divergence susceptibility, et cetera. So that I expect to guide the search for strange metals in the future. And then it would be interesting to in terms of trying to find an effective field theory, you can think of it in terms of holography. People have thought about this in the past, including at this institute, but it would be nice to combine this with these general constraints that we've derived. Maybe that will be the way forward to finally find this effective theory of a strange metal. And just to conclude, the point is that in quantum many-body physics, we have a Hamiltonian of a microscopic level, which is not solvable, and it's completely intractable to solve it. So what can we do? We can try to find an effective field theory of that. But even determining which effective field theory is the correct one for any given material is extremely difficult. But the way forward may be to find these general structural constraints that let you, from microscopic properties, predict or constrain properties of effective field theory. So that's, I think, a really promising way forward. I've described how to do it for metals in this talk, and then, you know, maybe many other materials, even that are not metals, will also be, have such constraints that you could derive. And so that's an exciting path for future. And I will stop there because I'm out of time. And I thank you for listening, and I thank my collaborators on this project as well.
Okay, thanks, Dominic, for the great talk. Are there any remaining questions from the audience?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Dominic. Very, very, very nice talk. So are there any subtleties in generalizing this to the spinful case when the spin is not conserved, when you have, let's say, spin-orbit interactions?
Well, actually, in that case, the only thing we need is the symmetry. So if you have spin-orbit, but spin is not conserved, then there's no difference from the spinless case, because it's just about the symmetries that we need.
I see.
Okay. If you have a spinful case where spin is conserved, then you have an enhanced symmetry, and you need to take that into account. But it's not too difficult to do that.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
I mean, I can ask because I'm still at this, but it will be very basic again. So if there are more reasonable questions, please go ahead. But I'm a bit confused by this infinite symmetry. This is something I'm not, it's not common, right? In quantum field theory, we write some Lagrangian and we have, okay, maybe we have some symmetry, but it's not infinite, right? Infinite is something very rare. Why do we get here? But you said we are used to in Fermi liquid and so on. So maybe there's a big field that I missed completely. Maybe there are some non-examples that I'm totally unaware of. So
well, maybe
when are we? When do we see this infinite symmetry, and what are the physical meaning of these infinite charges?
I mean, this may be the difference between, you know, quantum high energy theorists and condensed matter theorists. I mean,
probably yeah.
High energy theorists normally consider Lorentz invariant systems, and I don't know of any case where this would happen in a Lorentz invariant system, but suddenly this is the generic behavior for, you know, if you have some gas of electrons and they're at some density, I mean, even just putting a finite density is in some sense breaking Lorentz invariance. But if you have some gas electrons at finite density, I mean, this is the generic behavior. I mean, because of Fermi liquid theory and because of the constraints that I've derived, this must be always what happens. So in terms of a physical interpretation, I mean, it's literally just saying that, like, if you have a particle excitation here on the Fermi surface, that it stays here and it doesn't move. It doesn't move over here or over here. It just stays where it is. That's kind of a physical interpretation.
Okay, I think this is a good point to stop. So yeah, well, let's all thank Dominic again.